boys and girls. It's time to take a walk beyond the grassy knoll, to draw back the curtain to take a peek at the wizard. Visigoths Beyond the Grassy Knoll continues.
And here we are, as was so threatened, Beyond the Grassy Knoll continues. And we have with us today Gordon Comstock. The website is not ministryoftruth.com, which I said last time, which he must have been really pleased about, but it is gordoncomstock.com. And the name, obviously, is not lost on anybody who understands Orwell, and that is deliberate, okay? So understand that that's what that's all about. And I just want to welcome you back on. How the heck you been, Gordon?
Oh, thanks for having me on again.
Try again with a little more enthusiasm. But
it's funny how Orwell became, I use a word that you use all the time, my bailiwick. As I said last time, as I was turning the age of 30, I really needed a career, and I had a number of jobs that I just hated, and they didn't pay well. And I was one of those, I didn't come from a family setting that encouraged success, actually the opposite. So I didn't go to college until I decided to become a teacher. And I know that there's that old saying, those that can't teach. But I promise you, this is the one thing I really am good at. I'm teaching summer school now, and I can see that the faces light up of my students. And I actually have more liberty during summer school to teach novels and even grammar. I'm scoring some points. But my hands are tied during the school year with No Child Left Behind. But anyway, going back to school as I turned 30, I was desperate. So that's why I jammed through all these novels. And as I said last time, Orwell really struck a chord with me. And it goes, for me personally, it goes way back, actually.
Well, there's something I never did ask you, and I think it's probably because we talked a lot about it without being on record. And therefore, just, it's one of these things where, I know it, you know it, and we just forget that nobody else knows it. But, of course, it took me till, guess what, I was, 49. When I finally said, I've had enough of this, and I got to find out exactly what world I've been living in. Now, obviously, you're quite a few years younger than I, but, like you said, you decided to embark on a career teaching, which is no easy thing to do, without a doubt, a little later in life. And so then how did this vocation choice have anything to do with you're going down the rabbit hole, or was this coincidental, or the one coming after the other? How did it all work out for you?
Well, it kind of, not really, no, not for my choice of being a teacher. Although, right now, I'd say it's kind of a two-edged sword. On the one hand, I get to be a fun little termite in the system and spread little bits of subversive truth here and there amidst all the garbage I'm forced to teach. But on the other hand, it makes it tough, because nobody thinks like me in my profession. Oh, wow, no. They're all going out and voting now for Obama. So nobody knows. The teachers, most of them,
no clue.
Nearly all of them mean well, but they don't get it.
No. And I think they dare not get it, because if they did, their jobs would probably be on the line to a certain degree. And if they ever evinced any of that in the classroom, and of course you can speak to this yourself for however much you get away, I mean, again, what would it take? That's the thing that always struck me about it. I was in the education system down here in Florida, and I hated it. But all it takes is like for one parent to just become annoyed, and it's almost like it's all over. So, I mean, again, that teachers really, if they get it, don't want to speak too much about it. And the only ones that really do have an opportunity to do it are those that would be in, say, social studies, and English. Other than that, I mean, whatever. I mean, social study covers like what, poli-sci and all this stuff, geography, whatever. But you're the only ones that have an opportunity to do that. And if you do that, what have you found out? I mean, have you ever even tried to breathe such things in your school system?
Yep.
And how was that met with? What was that met with?
Well, I love to teach 1984, which is why I've read that particular Orwell novel 6 or 8 times now. I give a totally balanced approach, unlike probably nearly everybody else, who's only getting the mainstream spin. I present to them, I go into a couple of things. Well, okay. Because one of the main themes in 1984, with all of the propaganda from on high, from Big Brother, so one of the main themes is, how do you know what you know? Where, how can you trust your information sources? And so I really make them think, I first get the ball rolling by showing them, you know, interspersed with teaching the novel, I'll have them watch some old Apollo 11 documentary footage, and then the next day I'll hit them with a moon hoax video like by Bart Sobrel, and that's really, you can tell they're looking around, whispering at each other, saying, why haven't I heard this stuff before?
Mm-hmm.
And then we get a couple more chapters into it, and I have them watch that horrendously propagandistic Nova series, or that show, Why the Towers Fell. And then the next day I hit them with, it used to be Loose Change for a couple of years, but I've supplanted that with what I think is a slightly better one, the one by Sophia Smallstrom, 9/11 Mysteries. And man, you see head spinning in the, and you really get them thinking, and you can see it. It's awesome.
Well, I was just going to wonder. I mean, they're thinking, they go home and tell their parents who come back and say, what's with this? That hasn't happened to you, huh?
Not yet. Two things about that is I make sure I only spring it upon seniors. And, you know, as you said last time, they're halfway tuned out already. And they really, they're thinking for themselves at that point, more than, you know, obviously, the younger grades.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't had any complaints yet. But like I said, the other thing I do, I totally give a balanced approach. I do not tell them what to think. I just present them with the information of both sides, and I try to show them. What I tell them is, you know, considering looking at this 9/11 thing, what you guys got to realize is, no matter how you slice it, you are believing in a conspiracy theory, whether it's 19 Muslims living in caves, orchestrating and maintaining a conspiracy, or if it's elements of our own government pulling it off, it's a conspiracy. And what I really emphasize the point that if you're going to understand this novel, 1984, and understand what this character is going through, this is what they are going through. Being able to really looking at your own world and saying, wait a minute, how do I know that this, that what I'm told from authorities is true?
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think, and, you know, we really don't know for sure, but I'm going to go ahead and say this. And that's one of the reasons why I just wanted to come back, you know, for this year and do something after, you know, being down for 2 months. And that is, you know, I'm sorry. I mean, but 2008, to me, has begun the end of days, whatever we're headed for. Not the end of the world, nothing like that, but has definitely begun a new epoch where we're going to see things happen that we never thought would occur. You know, you see information that passes back and forth, and I'm not trying to engender, if you will, fear, but I think, you know, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and it smells like a duck, you might want to consider that it is a duck and that we're upon something that is not going to change. It's not going to roll back. And financially, we're seeing that, you know, through all different venues, but basically based upon, of course, two things: the rise in oil prices and the devaluation of the dollar. And, of course, the other thing that's been going on all along is the Federal Reserve printing more money out to the point where the M3 money supply is no longer posted because it's just astronomical.
Yeah.
So, and I think I might even send you some stuff, too. If I didn't, I was remiss in doing that with regard to the financial situation, and also one of those charts that showed just how much the little baby Federal Reserve Banks are borrowing from mom and pop Fed, which is by all means off the chart. So my point is that these children, you know, it's I feel badly for them in a sense, because they're going to be caught right in the middle of this machinery that is going to definitely how should I say, synthesize a new kind of life that not you, nor your folks, nor I, or my folks, or anyone really, have ever encountered. I mean, this is, I hate to say it, if not, if it isn't the word brave, it's certainly a new world that's coming.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and I'm saying this to you, being indelicate, because obviously, you know, you have a child, not even a year old, or just a year old?
A year and 6 months.
Boy, I can't believe it. I can remember when she was born. Holy mackerel, a year and 6 months. Oh. And I mean, obviously, it's harder for, you know, for yourself and for your wife and for all those who have young children. And there is this bit of, I think, about unwarranted optimism, some wishful thinking, because you have children, but it doesn't change the fact that what's coming down the pike. And it's not good. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. I mean, we are into something that is not going to turn around, and it's going to get exacerbated as we go along. Anyway, that takes us away from, in a sense, what we're talking about with Orwell, but it goes right back to what Orwell warned us about, and that is, and other authors did too, why did everyone portray the world to come as something very austere and bleak and regimented and, in essence, totalitarian? You know, what's your thought about that? You've seen the whole panoply of work about, you know, from all those science fiction or nonfiction writers.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was just their imaginations. I do think, especially with a few writers in particular who wrote dystopian novels, I think they were connected and were privy to certain information, certainly Aldous Huxley, and more, I am sure of, George Orwell,
mm-hmm.
who was at one time a pupil of Aldous Huxley was his French teacher. I didn't know that until recently. At one time at Eton, I guess.
Okay, and that's another thing, too, while we're on this, and I'm glad you brought that up because I had forgotten, because you had sent me a number of emails which were a bunch of ahas about Orwell's background, and one of them was just what you just said, right?
Yeah, I stumbled onto online, and, you know, it's pretty easy just to do a search like, you know, I'm a blue-collar guy. If you know how much my wife and I are working to the point where we hardly get to see our little baby right at the present. But so what I have here are not first-hand sources. They're online, for second-hand, third-hand. But I'll tell you what, I have read a heck of a lot of Orwell. I have read a heck of a lot of books about Orwell. What I'm finding out just from doing an internet search, these pieces fit together and make a lot of sense. And what I found, there's an article about Orwell being in the Fabian Society. Now, I had talked about Orwell's possible connections with MI5 last time. Just since I talked to you last time, he may have had those MI5 connections. He did, after all, have a background in law enforcement, so that's very legitimate, and that writer W.J. West writes about this in The Larger Evils. However, I'm coming to really suspect that the Fabian connection is a lot more significant. and I was able to procure a book at not a cheap price, and I got it used, but it's called Fabian Freeway by Rose Martin. Came out in 1968, and what do you know? It's out of print. Viz, why is it all these books that tell us really aha type of truths are out of print?
Who's the publisher on that, Gordon?
Let me see. But anyway, she claims to have been a member of
a former Fabian,
and. And she gives lists, just like the CFR gives lists in this book. Okay, it's Fidelis Publishers Incorporated, Santa Monica. Now, that's not a big name. However, it does say on the cover that it was a bestseller in hardcover in the late 60s. So why is this out of print? I wonder. But one thing, this article that I got online, it's by a guy. It's called Orwell's 1984, The Future is Here, by David Goodman. And it appeared in some publication called Insight on the News, December 31st, 2001. Goodman claims, among other things, that Orwell was a member of the Fabians and that 1984 was a satire directly. It was a kind of in-your-face, not a, at we patriots like the idiot, you know, patriots like Alex Jones want to say. No, he was throwing it in the face of the Fabians because, according to this book by Rose Martin, Orwell was in the Fabians from 1942 to 1947. Now, that, for me, answers a lot of questions. I have always wondered, what is it that totally wrecked Orwell's optimism about socialism right before he wrote Animal Farm in 1984?
Right.
Because Animal Farm came out in 43, and in 48, 1984 came out. Now, previously, he had a lot of optimism as to where socialism was going. And all of a sudden, he didn't anymore, and it was more, I think it really, it was more than just what he saw in communism perverting it. He saw, judging from these articles, that it was, behind the scenes, it was the Fabians supporting the communists. And let me tell you, the links, the little clues, I think, that give rise to the possibility that 1984 could be a direct satire upon the type of world that the Fabians wanted. And, okay, I told you last time that, and I accidentally said Maurice Webb. I was thinking Maurice Strong. What I meant was Sidney Webb
and his wife.
Beatrice Webb,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the two leading, founding Fabian socialists. And and in the book, there's a part that really kind of sticks out because there's this phrase called duck speak, which is when a guy on the news, on the telescreen, just talks without thinking. He's just like a gramophone mind, just repeats. He's like a parrot. But there's no other references to ducks or anything like that in the book, so there's a possibility that that was a reference to the webs, you know, webbed feet. But
So ducks have webbed feet, right?
Yeah, and it was it's kind of a sly, underhanded reference to the web. So
okay.
I'm beginning to believe that. But listen to this. What I didn't know until recently was the founding date to the founding year of the Fabians, of the Fabian Socialists, was 1884. And so what this guy, David Goodman, is claiming. And also, by the way, I also found this on a website called the www.modernhistoryproject.org. It says basically the same thing in a more succinct form. Orwell chose the title 1984 as another jab at the Fabian Socialists to mark the 100th anniversary, just to show them it's a reference back to 1884 when they were founded. And he really didn't have in mind that the world would be like this in 1984. He probably, you know, had in mind more our day.
Well, could it be that all of that is true? In other words, he might have done, and this is not unusual, I mean, when you take a look at all the levels of The Wizard of Oz, written by Frank Baum, when you take a look at 1984, he could have been whacking, I mean, he could have been telling a couple of allegories. You know, one might have been a broadside against the Fabians, but also about what is going to happen, which, you know, let's face it, I mean, the Fabians believed in. I mean, they believe in global socialism.
Yeah.
How draconian they want to get, I don't know. But, I mean, all those characters come out of, again, London and such, where it was stated, as we talked about, I forget who I, you know, was a guest on just before, last week, that talked about, you know, it was the white man's burden. Oh, Kipling. Yeah, Kipling said it, but Rose is there too. It's a white man's burden to basically rule the world. And it's like, you know, holy mackerel. I mean, these characters weren't kidding around. They were not. You know, socialism has got this, like, such nice connotation. Everything's, it's like the social word, and it's nice, and la-la-la-la. You know what? But I tell you what. Again, Hitler, Mao, you know, and Uncle Joe were all socialists. Socialism can get real nasty real quick. You just call it socialism, and you can get some legs with it. Call it communism or totalitarianism, everybody starts blowing chips. But the thing is, in essence, it's the same. It's the state just gotten worse, I think. So could it possibly be then, yes. So could it be, Gordon, that Orwell kind of hit a whole bunch of heads on different levels?
It could very well be.
Well, what do you feel? I mean, how much do you feel it really was some kind of, you know, allegory, you know, directed against the Fabians?
I mean, let me give you a couple more kickers. I mean, these, to me, seal the deal. What I'm reading now, I didn't know what Sidney Webb actually looked like, but according to this description I'm reading from, that article I found online, you know, in 1984, the description of the arch-villain, Emmanuel Goldstein?
Goldstein, yeah.
He had that, like, a billy goat kind of goatee, and he kind of looked Jewish.
Yeah, a little Trotskyite looking, and that was for a reason, yeah.
Well, according to this, that's pretty kind of exactly
what Webb looked like.
what Sidney Webb looked like. He had a billy goat goatee, and he was mistaken for being Jewish a lot just because of the way he looks. But even, you know, beyond that, the real kicker for me, and I did not call HarperCollins Publications to confirm this. You know, if you guys listening can go do that and find out if this is true, my hunch is you're going to find out this is true. If I was a betting man, according to these articles I found online, I'll just read this. This is incredible. Okay. This is from the modernhistoryproject.org. Okay. After it talks about how Orwell chose the name 1984 as the 100th anniversary of the Fabians' founding date, blah, 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 it says, the Fabian Society acquired and sealed the archives of Orwell when his second wife, Sonia, died some years ago. According to the representatives of the publishing company, HarperCollins, the Fabians will be in control of the 1984 copyright and name through the year 2025, and they have done their best to block unauthorized investigative research about Orwell's anti-socialist works. Even the rights to Orwell's estate fell under control of the Fabian Society. Now, if that is true, man, that seals the deal.
Yeah, because, I mean, why would they protest so much if it weren't directed toward them and they felt it?
Yeah, yeah. And they're, why are they sealing it? That's like sealing the JFK documents. Come on.
Yeah, I know. I mean, again, let me say I stand guilty, along with my parents and such, of being told by the government they're going to, I mean, and remember the assassinations that we watched. I mean, it was a bunch of them in a row. And we were just told, well, you know, we're not going to hear about this until, you know, 2025. And it's like, well, why? If you're telling us that isn't going to happen until then what are you telling us is in there? Stuff that we shouldn't know, which is, guess what? The bedrock of conspiracy, because it is a conspiracy.
Yeah, I think Orwell, when he got into the Fabians, he really way more than the average guy, he was an independent thinker. And they thought he'd be like most people and just toe the line. But no, that wasn't him at all.
But, you know, but Gordon, also, isn't it true? I mean, driven by whatever, you know, Orwell or Eric Blair went out and put his butt on the line. I mean, he got shot at, and he was in revolutions. And these other cats just sit there in the Coefficient Club, you know, in London, and sip tea or whatever they drink, and never put their butt on the line. And this guy comes back who was, you know, somewhat bloodied in the revolution. And he must look at them like, you guys are like totally just, you know, bullshit. Excuse me.
Oh, yeah. That's why, to me, Orwell was... He was a real guy. Yeah, you'd never see Huxley or H.G. Wells go live the squalid life of a miner for 6 months and go live as a homeless guy also and then write about it. They wouldn't deign doing that.
Or be a mercenary or a volunteer in the revolution. Off. Yeah, are you kidding? Ew, not that.
It's pretty miraculous, actually, that he survived. I mean, when you get shot in the neck, there aren't many non-vital things that a bullet can go
through. That he could have missed.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but that raises a good point. I don't know where you want to go from there. If you got some more quotes, I don't want to stop you from doing that. So first of all, I'm going to ask you if you have some, because I don't want to derail you from where you're going. Other than that, I would like to talk about what happened in the Revolution and whether or not that began a transformation of sorts and a metamorphosis of sorts in Orwell's life. So before I go off there, are there other places you want to go with the quotes that you have with regard to his relationship with the Fabians, etc.?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you this just one, this quick quote from Slater, and this kind of buttresses what I said before myself. I'm glad to see that Slater noticed this too and was commenting on it. The sudden change in Orwell around 1942-43 from optimism about socialism to total pessimism. Slater writes, and this is Ian Slater from The Road to Airstrip 1, he writes, "The appearance of Animal Farm in 1945, because it took 2 years to publish, it was too hot to publish, and 1984, which came out in 1949, constitutes a pessimistic and drastic reassessment of Orwell's earlier hopes for the disappearance of class distinctions." Yes, that sums it up. The something Orwell was introduced to at that time changed him, I think, and, well, for me, I think his introduction into Fabian socialism gave him a really bad taste.
Let me ask you this first. I got a follow-up question. We're both... I know 1984 was published in the United States. Did Orwell have to move the publishing of Animal Farm to the United States as well, or was that just 1984? The original publication.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think it was the Warburg publisher who finally published Animal Farm, but it took 2 years. And yeah, here's a guy, Orwell. He was born into the middle class, but his parents overachieved and sent him to Eton. And he was always known there as, you know, one of the boys who couldn't really afford to be there, but they were taking him on at a discounted tuition as a favor to his dad, who was a constable in India. And so he was a middle-class guy. He was not an elitist, but he did get the education of an elitist, but he never lost that distinction of, I'm not one of these guys. He despised intellectuals. And so... what he did have, though, even though he retained this middle-class mindset, he had the connections of an elitist. He had a publisher who was a Warburg, like I said, and before that...
That's interesting, yeah.
He had a connection to a publisher who was... last name was Astor, was a member of the Astor clan. And what I didn't know last time I had mentioned that Orwell was also riling up the regular socialists. What I was thinking there... what I had in mind was his original publisher, whose name was Victor Golands. I thought Victor Golands was just a hardworking, regular, idealistic socialist type. Oh, no. What I found in this Rose Martin book is Victor Golands' name is right next to Orwell's in the roster of Fabian socialists.
Okay. Well, going back to... Eric Blair's life when he goes off to the Spanish Civil War and then comes back, and I think that whatever period that is, I guess somewhere in the mid-30s to obviously late 40s, and that's all that's left for him, about 15 years, I think he went through a number of transformations. That's what I picked up from Slater's book, which is now in your hands.
Yeah.
First of all, Did you pick that up as well? I mean, did you see somebody? I mean, there's all this other talk, and I think some of the bibliographical notes or site notes talk about his paranoia in France after he had been wounded, like he thought he was going to get assassinated. I don't know what that was all about. Maybe in
Spain, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think he came back to France and was saying, you know, they're out for me or whatever. But no matter.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it may have been in France. I thought it was Spain, but I could be wrong. Yeah, you're talking when he met Hemingway in a cafe?
Or there was some other talk about him meeting somebody, I believe it was in a Paris hotel or whatever, but he was extremely overwrought and thought that he was being, you know, looked for. And being paranoid doesn't mean you're wrong. You know, why they might have wanted to clip him, I don't know, unless they felt he was going to go back and... I don't know, do something revelatory about whatever he had witnessed in the Spanish Civil War. But go ahead.
Why they wanted to clip him, as you say, he had just gotten out of the hospital from his near-death experience, basically. He survived the sniper wound to the neck. And when he got out of the hospital, the anarchist unit that he had been fighting for had been suppressed and were being hunted down by the Stalinist forces who had backstabbed them, basically. They were supposed to be working together against the Francoists. And I don't know if you've ever read any Franz Kafka novels.
Well, of course, The Great Metamorphosis and a little bit of, Enemy of the State or something like that.
So if I use that adjective Kafkaesque, you know what that means?
Yeah.
You know what? It means
surreal.
a surreal experience with government officials mm-hmm. who are out to get you, and you don't know why. And the scary thing is, they don't even know why, but they want you. And reading the last couple of chapters in Homage to Catalonia, which is Orwell's account of what he saw in the Spanish Civil War, that's where he talks about. Fleeing with his wife had come to get him and whispered to him, don't talk out loud, we can't talk here. And his wife told him, you're being hunted down, we got to get you out of here. And he and his wife had to go very circuitously and get out of the country while the government was after them, the Stalinists and the Francoists. And it's very Kafkaesque, the description. He almost got killed several times. His buddies, who he had fought with, were being thrown in jail, never to be released. They just rotted there. And so that's why they wanted him. He was fighting for the wrong side all of a sudden.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say this, and this is just a really, really, crass reference to this whole bit about the government and this kind of Kafkaesque relationship, but I just got done watching, I don't know, something ridiculous with about Adam Sandler and Jack Nicholson, and he has to go into this anger management thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see this thing at all?
You
I forget
what?
The name of it.
That was on TV.
Yeah, it was. But I mean,
he was over watching TV. I literally don't watch it anymore. But that happened to be on, and I caught like 5 seconds of it. I haven't seen it though.
No, I mean it was like, you know, it was an insomnia. I had to turn the TV on thing, and he's on a plane, and he just wants a headset to listen to the movie, and the steward, the flight attendants are dissing him, and he just says, "Look, can I just get this?" And they come back and go, "Why are you yelling?" He says, "Well, I'm not yelling." Yes, you're yelling, and you know, why don't you stop? And like, you know, then some kind of U.S. Marshal comes up and tins him and says, "Why are you getting out of control?" You know, but this is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
With regard to what Kafka did, and also what Blair was also trying to get across, it is absolutely surreal, and that's what they work in. They work in this like other plane that when you get in, Lord knows you'll never get out.
It's a maze that you can get lost in and killed in, and they'll just lose your paperwork. And
well, let me ask you this too, because I've not thought about this, and this may be unfair to put it to you, but I mean, it was just your opinion, and it's worth for everybody else, because me and folks listen to it, and they come up with their own ideas. They don't, you know, put their trust in us, and that's a good thing to do, not to do. But how much? I mean, do you think that Orwell wrote 1984 with, shall we say, the megaphone directed toward the United States, or did he just say, this is the garbage that's going to go down in the English-speaking Western world? What do you think?
This is the common misperception, and this goes back to the lunkhead patriots who claim that Orwell was just like Aldous Huxley, you know, Alex Jones, rubbing it in your face.
Yeah, bad guy, yeah.
And he was a bad guy, and what they haven't read Orwell, and they haven't read about his life, and they don't understand the tone of that novel, 1984. It's a satire. It's an extremely dark satire. It goes back to when that book came out in the 1950s, this patriot misconception goes way back. In the 1950s, you had Birchers. John Birch Society members.
I remember them well, yeah.
They were distributing 1984 and saying, George Orwell, this Englishman is warning of Stalinist Russia. What they totally didn't get, they were too obtuse to get, is Orwell was warning about a future totalitarian for whatever type of government. He said any type of government that we have right now can morph into this. That's why the whole world is this, that whole three-part world Orwell wrote about, the Oceania, East Asia, Eurasia, they're all in on it. And there are several quotes that Ian Slater gives in his book of Orwell, where he noted that he saw that capitalism and communism were morphing into the same thing, and he called it oligarchical collectivism. And you and I, I'm going through that unpublished manuscript by Maureen Heaton right now,
okay,
where we all would call it the new feudalism.
And Maureen Heaton, that can be accessed on
AmericanDeception.com.
Right, which is the son of Charlotte Isherbit, Sam.
Yes. Yeah.
Who's got a great site there, and that whole thing is there. Hey, by the way, and we'll get back to the nitty-gritty, what did you think about Heaton's book, All Told?
I'm about halfway through it. Sam Isherbit said I could read it and put it out online. And so,
good.
Doing that because... You know what it is? It's really weird. You get a lot of books exposing New World Order, Illuminati, whatever you want to call it. You get a lot of books exposing that from a big picture point of view.
That's true.
What Maureen Heaton provides, you don't see much of this because it really requires being active at the local level. She presents the picture in very fastidious detail of really the New World Order, the Illuminati, whatever, how it operates at the its tentacles are.
It trickles down to us, yeah.
How it trickles down to us and affects our local communities. That's what she provides.
Oh, and that's so easy now too, because it doesn't take a lot. I mean, everybody's watching the Today Show and all this other crap. So no matter where you are, I mean, whatever they promote, people are integrating, and if they don't question things, I mean, they're willing dupes, obviously. So I think even beyond when Maureen wrote that book, I think she wrote it, what, was in the 50s, perhaps?
She was writing for, I guess, a couple of decades, but she finally finished it, but died before she could publish it in 1990, was when it was finished.
All right, but, with the advent of, probably before she began the book, I mean, we know the TV was a force, no doubt, it was a big force, but, of course, now we look at it 24/7, and radio and such, and people, obviously are being propagandized as much as they want to be. So that, it can go down a local level easily because everybody's listening to the same stuff. And, of course, whatever it is, whether it's state legislators or county magistrates or whether it's local, councils or whatever, they're all parroting the same stuff. So, without a doubt, it goes all the way down through. So, it's even easier now because people are so much more propagandized with the advent of 24/7 TV and, of course, all the alphabet networks and all their subsidiaries or whatever that are telling you what you should think. It's obviously a tough, tough juggernaut to fight against. And I would say that probably the battle's being lost. But for those souls, and there are, people every day, that poke their head up and go, I'm not buying this crap anymore. That still happens, but boy, there's so many people out there who are just buying this whole bag of, a stim and dung. I mean, it's hard. It's just hard to fight against. But listen, we've gone almost to 40 minutes. And Gordon, I'll tell you what. Tell folks about the website. Tell folks, what is there, and why in the world, actually, we really didn't address this at the outset, that you ever decided to, jack up your boots and do this?
Well, I suppose the fact that my wife and I, can't even go to church in my community, can't even go to a true New Testament church in my own community is one big reason why I'm doing this. I told you what you were a really big inspiration for me to start my own show. I make no bones about that. But what I kind of tweaked what you were doing and made it more specifically to try to reach Christians. And And yeah, there's a lot of secular stuff there, Orwell and all this other stuff, but it's time Christians got out of their insular lifestyles and actually looked around at the world around them and actually saw what's going on. I mean, so anyway, my whole goal is to wake up a few Christians, if I can, to where we are in this world. You have so many movements within Christianity that are predominant right now that are seeing some kind of revival coming, some kind of dominionist kingdom of heaven on earth. I mean, this is anti-scriptural. This is it's just so obtuse. But anyway, what it has done is rendered the church unable to function according to its New Testament design. They have kowtowed completely. About 99% of churches in this country are not churches. They are corporations. They have acquiesced. They have rendered over their authority to the state. That is one of my big bailiwicks that I really try to drive home a lot is the church needs to wake up and come out of the auspices of human government in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got no argument for me, that's for sure.
Oh, man. My wife and I, we were going to a local church for a while, a local corporate church for a while, and, you know, it's been a month. We haven't been back. We got tired of looking at the blank stares and the feel-goodisms. That's not what's happening, folks. Look around. I could go on and on.
Well, no, but I mean, let's face it. I mean, this goes on with any kind of media, with churches. If you don't make them feel good, they won't support you, and you'll fade away.
Yeah.
So if you're supported by, whether it's, you know, church, free will offerings, or whatever, or advertising, if you're not making people feel good, they won't listen, the advertisers will leave. And so there's never really been, and of course this is the truth after, and I think there's a distinction that has to be made here. Especially back in the era of just newspapers, just before radio came upon the scene. And that is when newspapers stopped being completely subsidized by subscriptions and newsstand sales. When they went to advertising to keep them going, that's when they lost their free voice.
Yeah.
Now, it's also documented that Rockefeller and Carnegie grabbed, you know, a whole bunch of, what, maybe 15 publishers and said, this is the way it's going to go, guys. And that's why when people go, well, if it's a conspiracy, how could they keep it quiet? Well, first of all, just corner the money.
25 publishers, yeah.
Yeah, and corner the information outlets and get the government, and the government will give you its military, and that's it. And that's it.
Yeah.
That's where we are now. So we've never really had a free press in the 20th century, and that's something that people have to realize, is that this is all driven by agendas and other viewpoints beyond just the truth, or at least, I mean, I had a laugh because somebody said to me, he goes, well, Fox is fair and balanced. I go, why? Because they said so? I mean, come on. What? They said it was fair and balanced, so that makes it true? But, I mean, anyway, that's the way it is, and that's what we're fighting against, without a doubt. But I want to ask you something else, if I could. And, again, I'm telling you, folks, we're talking to Gordon Comstock, and his website's gordoncomstock.com. There's plenty of stuff up there, plenty of audio, please avail yourself of what's up there, if you would. And he's good also about answering emails, and, there's not a problem there. I can say that without a doubt. One of the things I was also wondering about is I understand why Slater would pose this question, because to me, I understood the answer. But he said, you know, and it was almost a criticism, but it was like, well, you know, Orwell posed a lot of questions, but in the end, he really didn't give any kind of solutions.
Yeah.
And I think you know where I'm going. My point is, well, because these solutions don't exist, and he knew everything was a chasing after the wind. What do you think?
I think that I totally agree with you. I think Slater missed the boat on that one. I think Slater is basically, by nature, an optimistic person, and he just couldn't digest what Orwell was all about near the end there. I think it even caused Slater's temperament probably, I think, caused him to kind of get into wishful thinking in his interpretation of 1984. He gives some what I think are kind of weak reasons to find what he thought was sources of potential optimism in the world, in this dystopian world that Orwell wrote about. And every time I found Slater trying to, like, I'll give you a couple of examples.
Okay.
The fact that Orwell, the proles were allowed to play the lottery. And Slater, and of course it was just to dumb them down further, keep them occupied, keep them busy. There weren't even any, the prizes were even
right.
fake.
That's right.
But it kept them busy like stupid animals. Now, I thought, I still think, Orwell put that in there to show you how completely hapless, how completely hopeless the proles were. And the leaders, the inner party was laughing at them. But Slater somehow saw that as a potentially weak link, a chink in the armor of Big Brother, because you never know, with luck, the proles might start really getting into this luck thing and think that they could take a shot at ruling themselves through this luck thing. I didn't see that at all. The other thing is the proles are allowed to... the Big Brother cranks out these corporate songs on the radio, you know, kind of like we have in our top 40 payola system mm-hmm. of radio music. Well, Big Brother cranks them out on this... They're even written on a machine that writes out robotic, this music. The machine's called the Versificator. Just to tell you that even the music is not written by any human creativity. Human creativity is not allowed in this society. Slater sees that as a reason that Orwell was showing you that someday, maybe, the proles, if they're allowed to sing these songs and change and alter the words, singing them from street to street, they could make up a revolutionary song someday, and then they could, you know, have a revolution against Big Brother. And I didn't see that at all. What I saw is again, Orwell was emphasizing the fact that the inner party was so secure in their position over these tremendously dumbed down animal-like proles that they could let them sing whatever they wanted. They didn't have to worry about a thing. But so Slater, I think he's basically an optimistic guy, and he sees what he wants to see, and I'm seeing what I want to see, and I think it's a pessimistic. Everything's pessimistic in that book.
Still in all, I think that Slater did a pretty fair job. Of course, no one's going to be like okay with everything. But I thought, all in all, I don't know. I mean, you've read more books on Orwell than I have. I thought he did a reasonably fair job. I thought he was a decent referee, if you will.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Overall, I hasten to say, Slater did a really good job overall. Yeah.
Now there's a question too, and I don't know if that it's not moot, that it also isn't just, I don't know, somewhat, I guess, convoluted. It'll bring you back to the beginning again. And that is, he said, was Orwell warning us or was he prophesying? And I think, you know, last year or so, whatever, I said, like, well, what's the difference, really? Because in a sense, a warning, not, even if it is somewhat observed or heeded, will turn into a prophecy. I mean, you know, what's a warning but it's telling you this is what's going to happen, but that's a prophecy as well. I don't know, we should cut it so thin, and I might be off base on that, but between prophecy and warning, do you draw a distinction? And if so, what do you think Orwell gave us with, of which did he give us with both Animal Farm and 1984?
Man, you know...
Tough one,
I don't know.
Yeah,
I know. I don't know. It's too much of an enigma. I know he was in a very dark, dark place, especially when he wrote the last one, 1984. But there is an account that Slater gives, a letter Orwell had written 7 months after he published 1984, and he died, of course, very shortly after that. And Orwell was saying how he, talking about his plans, what he wanted to do if he could just shake this tuberculosis, you know, and he had some actual plans he wanted to do and some messages to get out with further books. I just think people go through phases, and the phase he was in when he wrote 1984 was completely fatalistic. He,
mm-hmm.
It was exacerbated by a couple of deaths in his family that were really, close to him, his wife and his sister, that would affect anybody and turn their mood bleak for people go through grieving periods.
But as you just said also, could it not be that Slater, being an optimist, was thinking that, and of course, when he wrote it, and this is back, what, in the 80s, I believe.
Yeah.
If Slater was an optimist, and I believe he was, as you said, accurately, if he thought it was, and I think he definitely believed it was a warning, but because he was optimistic, my point is, no, he was, Orwell was being prophetic. Slater didn't want to believe that that was going to be the way it was, and therefore called it a warning. And now, of course, too, we have the benefit of almost, what, you know, 20 years, actually over 20 years. And we can turn around, and would you pile on, as I would, with the fact that, no, Orwell was prophesying?
Well, I think we can definitely, it definitely justifies using that adjective, prophetic, considering all that has come true in both Animal Farm and 1984. I think of people nowadays who even get it, people like the really smart people, like the Collins brothers and other people who write book reviews and that I've read, where what they'll write is how Aldous Huxley's Brave New World has come true a lot more than Orwell's 1984. And when I read that and hear that, I'm scratching my head thinking, what are you seeing? I mean, yes, it's true. Huxley's book has come true, like, in so many ways that we could go into. But, I mean, it is at least equally true that 1984 is all around us. I mean, when I see something like Blackwater, that the mercenary group that we send over and pay ten times as much as our army to go kill people in Iraq, and who knows what they might do here someday. I'm sorry, you look at an organization like Blackwater, that's straight out of 1984, not Brave New World. And so, yeah, and plus the false flag operations that are in 1984. Well, we see that right and left in our society now with the Oklahoma City bombing and 9/11 and on. So, yes, 1984 and Orwell, they're extremely prophetic.
Right, you never really found anything that was satisfactory with a link between Orwell being involved with Tavistock, right?
No, just that brief blurb on, from that one website you found, and I know that John Coleman said he wasn't, and
yeah.
I figure he would know something. I'm definitely leaning towards the Fabian Society now.
But also,
what else he had?
Well, I mean, but remember too, he had just come out also of writing for the the Ministry of Propaganda, wasn't it? What was it called? What was the British equivalent? He was writing propaganda for the BBC, wasn't he?
Yeah, the Ministry of, oh gosh.
See, the truth of propaganda, but it's the same thing.
Yeah, and it's really funny how he would get jobs like that, and he could always also, by the way, get mysterious loans from mysterious persons when he needed to. He didn't often avail himself of it, but it happened more than once in his life, and his wife was able to get these mysteriously, incredibly high-level jobs in the censorship department during World War II, so there's just all kinds of fishy stuff going on with the guy. I don't know what that ministry was called.
Yeah, but it was almost right out of his book, by the way. For those who have come upon this interview, who have not listened to us in time gone by, we would, I'll tell you what, I'm going to let you summate, and that is, when we look at Orwell, Eric Blair, do we see a bad guy or, in the end, a good guy who is trying to tell us this is the shape of things to come?
Yeah, this goes way back for me, and it gets into that thing about lunkhead patriots not just saying things about Orwell that they don't, if they just repeat what somebody else said. I'll tell you, and this goes back to the first moment in my life when I got it, even though I didn't really get it. For me, understanding how the world really works has come in stages, but my first stage was way too young. I think I was 5 years old, and my mom and dad, we were in a mall or something, maybe even a toy store. I remember coming out of this store feeling all giddy. Maybe it was Christmas time, and you had that giddy kid feeling of I'm going to get toys or whatever. And we got in the car, and my dad, who knew some of this stuff, what he did, and my mom, who didn't know any of this stuff, they were talking, and my dad, just as we were getting in the car, my dad got to telling my mom about this Antichrist figure who was going to be in power someday, and he was going to make everybody take this mark, and if you didn't take it, he was going to make you starve. And that was my first introduction to evil. I mean, real evil in my life at 5 years old. And it,
yeah,
all that ride home, I had this feeling in my stomach of, oh, my God, somebody is going to be so evil someday that they're going to want to starve me. And then in the years after that, my dad would sometimes talk about this Illuminati thing. And my dad made a big mistake there. He should never have told somebody, being that young, he should never have done that to me. You know, wait till they're a teenager, say. But I'll tell you what, now looking back, I'm glad he did tell me about this stuff rather than not tell me at all. And I would be, you know, I'm glad I know, put it that way. There were two or three times when I was, say, 8, 9, 10 years old, where the name George Orwell came up with my dad. And my dad told me, yeah, that Orwell guy, he was rubbing it in our faces, telling us what rich people like him are going to do to the world someday. And then, jump forwards 20 years, and I'm studying to be a teacher, I'm almost 30, and I encounter, for the first time, I seriously sit down and get into the book 1984, and I read this book. And my father had just passed away, by the way. And just my first go-through with that book, and my goosebumps all over my body, I realized this Orwell guy, he was not in favor of this stuff at all. He was warning about it, and I realized it, and I was just thinking to myself, Dad, you had it wrong about this guy, and I wish I could tell you now. And so this misunderstanding of it, so-called patriot types who think that Orwell was a bad guy, it goes way back.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear patriot types like right now, guys like Walt Williams and Eric Phelps and many others I've personally spoken to, who have parroted that same line to me about Orwell was, like Alex Jones, rubbing it in our faces. No, dudes, you got to...
trying to tell us, yeah.
You got to read, study up. That wasn't Orwell. He was a decent guy.
Yeah, and no matter what he went through, the thing is that at the end, he was a clarion that was telling us, this is what's going to happen. He was not a proponent of it. He was saying, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then he gets affixed, obviously, with being the more than just a messenger, but the actual originator of the message, which is not true. He finally turned around, and if you would, you know, turn states on the state and told us, this is what's going to happen. And, of course, it is happening to a T. With the group hate and trying to find a boogeyman like Emmanuel Goldstein to hang out in front of the people. And we've seen it with Bin Laden and with Saddam Hussein and, you know, with, Kim in North Korea. I mean, the group hate is there all the time. I mean, he told us the game plan, and we're seeing it now, and we don't realize it because...
Biz, if people are going to scoff at that, the illusions I've made of the duck speak line in 1984 and some abstract hints of Fabian of Orwell, as you said, turning it against them. You got to understand, if he is going to get a book published and criticize these people, he's got to couch it in very abstract terms,
they're
in control of the publishing houses.
That's right, and hence that's why he had to go to the United States. They wouldn't do it first here in the UK.
Yeah, okay.
I believe that was the case in 90.
That could very well have been, yeah.
I think 84, yeah, 1984 was published first here, and then later it came back to them. Also, I want to tell you this before we get into the goodbyes, but in tribute to what you've said about the little wink and a nod about duckspeak and the webs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I'm going to play, and you'll not be able to really hear as I bid you goodbye, but you'll be able to hear on the audio file. We're going to do a little thing, which I think would be funny, but weren't so true. Going back to Monty Python and what the peasants were doing with the witch. Do you remember the witch?
Oh yeah.
Well, whips, you know, well, she might be the same weight as a duck. Okay.
They turned me into a newt. Oh yeah, I can quote that.
Well, I got better.
Yeah.
So anyway, with the webs and the duck's beak, and I just happened to have recorded this before, and while you were speaking, I went rummaging through all my little CDs. And this will be our outro music, which isn't music at all. But I think, you know, again, on many levels, unfortunately, this is so true. And this is from Monty Python back in, like, the early 70s. And we'll also affix it to the Fabians and the webs and Duckspeak. But anyway, before we let you go, again, folks, this is Gordon Comstock. The website is GordonComstock. My lips work for a certain amount of time. .com. And you can go there, and there will be a number of audios. He's very generous about what's up there. And a whole lot of other information. I would ask you to, folks to please, by all means, go there. The website unofficially is titled Ministry of Truth. Gordon, you okay with all that?
Oh, yeah.
All right, bro. What?
Yeah, no, you got it. Sorry.
What? No, what? What?
You know, I originally tried. I wanted to have it be ministryoftruth.com. No, that was taken.
Yeah, and for some reason, subliminally or subconsciously, I think,
oh,
what?
Can I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
Doggone. If any, okay, I want to tell
Do
you
it.
your listeners of a site to watch out for. I think I found me a real spook site. Now, maybe you'll help me out. Is it true that on the internet, if it's one of those funny sites like that, are they more likely to be the first one up if you do a Google search? Does Google have control over things like that?
Well, do I know for a fact? No. Would it make sense that Google would put people, you know, would put some stuff up first?
Yeah.
We all know that the perfidy that Google has perpetrated. But do I know for a fact? No. But where are you going with this?
Okay, there's a site, and I'm pretty sure it's out of England. And this person who runs it has the fake name Jackie Jura. And, you know, it's because Jura was the name of the island he went and
okay, good,
lived
okay.
on. And when you go there, it even looks real creepy because it has the pyramid with the all-seeing eye on top. It's called OrwellToday.com. I'm pretty sure that's a spook site or something very questionable.
And it whacks Orwell, too, right?
What's that?
It whacks Orwell, too, doesn't it?
Well, what they do is they'll take emails from people and print them questions about Orwell, like he's some kind of expert, this Jackie Jura person. And what they'll do is any type of anything having to do with conspiratorial anything, they'll poo-poo it and print your letter, your question, with their response, their poo-poo response. And what happens, though, is when you write back and say, look, what you did doesn't make sense because blah, 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 and even when you call them on it where they're being hypocritical, they'll never print your response letter, your rebuttal letter. But everything about Orwell is just totally on the level and mainstreamy, and that's all you'll get on this site, and I'm pretty sure it's a spook site. It's a disinfo site. Watch out for it.
All right, good enough, and everybody will go there, and they'll be happy as heck to get all these hits, but it's
yeah,
true.
I'm sure,
you're right,
yeah.
No problem.
But he's a jerk. Watch out for him.
Woo! All right, this has been Gordon Comstock, and again, like we said, the website is GordonComstock.com, and we've been talking about Orwell, and we've been doing this for quite some time, and I don't think the whole deal is really over, but this brings us up kind of to a date, because Gordon had asked for that book, Orwell, The Road to Airstrip 1, and he got it and did his exegesis of it, and it was worth it, so thanks a lot, and Gordon, I'll tell you what, we'll see each other down the road. And as you can enjoy, as we say goodbye, Monty Python and the way things really are with people in the world today.
Okay, God bless, Vince.
We'll see you later. All righty, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The witch, may we burn her?
Burn her!
How do you know she is a witch?
She looks like one.
Yes, she does. Bring her forward.
I'm not a witch. I'm not a witch.
But you are dressed as one.
They dress me up like this. And this isn't my nose. It's a false one.
Well?
Well, we did do the nose.
The nose?
and the hat. But she's a witch.
Yeah.
Did you dress her up like this?
No.
Yes.
Yeah, a bit. She has got a wart.
What makes you think she is a witch?
Well, she turned me into a newt.
A newt?
I got better.
Burn her, Eddie!
Burn! There are ways of telling whether she is a witch.
Are there? Huh? What are they? Tell us!
Can I hurt? Tell me, what do you do with witches? And what do you burn apart from witches?
For witches!
Wood! So, why do witches burn?
Because they're made of wood.
Good! So, how do we tell whether she is made of wood?
Build a bridge out of her!
Ah, but can you not also make bridges out of stone?
Oh, yeah.
Does a wood sink in water?
No.
It floats!
Throw her into the pond!
What also floats in water?
Bread! Apples!
Very small rocks!
Cider!
A great gravy!
Cherries!
Mud!
Churches!
Lead!
A duck!
Exactly! So, logically,
if she weighs the same as a duck, she's made of wood!
And therefore,
a witch!
A witch!
Very good, we shall use my larger scales.